Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Mark Fallon. To set some context on Mark's background and career, before we get into our in-depth conversation on interview and interrogation and obtaining the truth with legally, morally, and ethically based means, it really is important to set the stage with understanding pieces of his background. So we will start with the fact that he's currently the director of Club Fed, where he works hard to advance science-based interview and interrogation techniques. As we begin to work backwards, he has served as a consultant on interrogation for the Department of Defense, on the Advisory Council for the Center of Ethics and Rules of Law at the University of Pennsylvania. He was on the steering committee of experts that oversaw the development of the Mendez Principles for Effective Interviewing. He is the former assistant director of training at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, the former assistant deputy assistant director of counterterrorism at NCIS. Following the September 11th attacks, he was appointed special agent in charge of the Pentagon Task Force, established to bring terrorists to justice before military commissions. Beyond all of that, Mark is the author of Unjustifiable Means, the inside story of how the CIA, Pentagon, and U.S. government conspired to torture. He is also a co-editor of Interrogation in Torture, Integrating Efficacy with Law and Morality, and the co-editor of Interviewing and Interrogation, a review of research and practice since World War II. And that's just a piece of his background as it relates to interview and interrogation and obtaining the truth. And I'm very excited to share this conversation with all of you to talk through his experience, his stories, his ideas on how not only we can apply these techniques and lessons in investigative interviewing, but also in our business and our personal conversations as well. Because after all, getting a confession from somebody is really just encouraging them to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences. And we do that every day. So as we look at just a few of the topics that we are going to cover today with Mark, he is going to get into the true and negative impacts of torture in ways that hopefully make some of us kind of stop and think that through for a few moments. The difference between focusing on getting the truth and getting a confession, effective presentation of evidence, not just the evidence you should have, but how and when to present it, even how to set it up, principles for effective interviewing that we referenced before, and of course, plenty of stories and examples from his spectacular career. So I appreciate you all being here today. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us. Before we get started, let's take a moment to thank our sponsors. First, we have Humantel. If you haven't already, please head over to humantel.com and enter the code INQUASIVE25 to get 25% off their best-in-class online self-paced training to recognize when people's emotions are shifting through their facial expressions and non-verbal communication. I highly recommend it. I've done it all myself. Check it out at humantel.com. You can also read all of their articles, blogs, check their research. It's all there for you. For the professional interviewers, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn more about joining the International Association of Interviewers, either as an individual or a team. What are the resources available, the networking opportunities, the online and in-person education opportunities, so much more. That's also where you can get your questions answered on the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. What does it take to qualify? How do you pass the exam? How do you maintain the designation? What could it mean for you and your career? All of that and more at certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, please head over to INQUASIVE.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs that our clients ask us to customize for their senior leaders, sales teams, and HR teams to teach them how to apply the strategic and ethical observation and persuasion techniques necessary to obtain the everyday confessions. All of that and more at INQUASIVE.com. We really appreciate you being here today. Thank you so much. So much to learn from Mark. So without further ado, I introduce to you Mark Fallon. Good morning, Mark. It is great to see you. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm doing well.
Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. As we said in the introduction, you've been so many places and worked on so many things. You have so much experience. I'm really excited to dive in and share as much of your perspective as we can get into an hour or so as we can. And to start the conversation, I think I'd like to go in a direction that I've never gone with anybody before on the show and talk about torture. I'll let people's necks snap back. And here's the question that I'd like to ask. I think intuitively, when we think about torture or enhanced techniques, whatever label we want to put on it, we think, okay, that's probably bad. You shouldn't want to do that to another human being. And if you put people under enough pain, they'll just tell you whatever they want to make the pain go away. So I think that's hopefully, at least at that level, intuitive to some people. But from all of the research you have done and the groups that you have been a part of, what effect does torture or some of these enhanced techniques have on the subject who we are hopefully trying to get truthful information from?
Yeah, that's a great question. And unfortunately, my name is linked to the word torture. You can Google Mark Fallon and torture, and there'll be a ton of things that come up. The first way I'd like to maybe address that is I'm often asked, does torture work? And I have to say that torture does work. Torture is an effective tool to implement if you're seeking a certain outcome. So it would be like asking, does rape work? Right? Does pedophilia work? Does genocide work? So the second question is, does it work for what? Right? So what is it you're attempting to achieve? If you're attempting human subjugation, if you're attempting to reduce somebody to, as the CIA and others have done, to an infantile state, to break them down emotionally as a human being, well, then torture is effective in doing that. It will do that to the human subject that you're working on. Now, you know, we have a horrible history with this. And you mentioned enhanced interrogation techniques or enhanced techniques. And that's a label that the CIA gave to they made it up, their program. There was nothing enhanced about it. When people talk about EITs, I try to correct the record and say that was actually an excuse to inflict torture, because they came across with the subterfuge that torture was safe, and we know it's not safe, and I'll get to that with some of the human subjects who've been tortured, that torture is effective. And again, that gets to the question of effective for what? If it's about eliciting accurate, reliable information, well, then the record's crystal clear. I mean, it does not do that. Your memory shuts down. You'll say anything you want, as you mentioned, to get the pain to stop, and you'll get inaccurate information. But they said it was necessary, and the record is clear that it is not necessary. That we, for instance, on the USS Cole Task Force and the Aden bomb investigation with the FBI, use rapport-based techniques that we had used historically and elicited accurate, reliable information and actionable intelligence and things like that. And so the issue of whether a torture is effective, again, goes to for what? We went to war with Iraq partially based on information from a prisoner, Ibn Sheikh Alibi, who was tortured. And he said there was Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And people who've worked terrorism cases in the past, like myself, who started with the Blind Sheikh in the 90s in the first World Trade Center attack, worked with the Joint Terrorism Task Force in New York City, we looked at that information and said, it is nonsensical, right? It is nonsensical that there's some allegiance between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. It wasn't tracking with, we knew from the historical record, it wasn't tracking from all of the interviews and interrogations we were already doing, not just in the Cole investigation, but post 9/11. As you noted in your introduction, I was the chief investigator for Al-Qaeda for military commissions right after 9/11, when President Bush decided to use military commissions and his authority under Article 2 of the Constitution, the military, rather than in Article 3, the federal district courts. And so we had, I think, the 2.5 years I was the special agent in charge of the task force, I think my staff estimated that we conducted probably about 10,000 interviews or interrogations around the world. It was a global task force. We had people in, not just people look at Guantanamo as a task force, but that's where the prisoners were. We were in Afghanistan. We were in Iraq. We were traveling globally to make cases, trying to make cases for these military commissions. So what we know from the record was Ibn Sheikh Ghalibi says it was Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And while it made no sense, that information was used for policy decisions before the UN by Colin Powell to try to get a coalition to try to support a war with Iraq and to incite the American public that somehow Iraq was behind 9/11, which is nonsensical to start with. But so they used that to beat the drums for war. And we did go to war with Iraq. And frankly, we lost that war, right? And just like in Afghanistan, we didn't win that war either. We lost a lot of American lives. Blood was shed over this. And so the core issue central to what we're talking about is that the product of torture, while was effective tactically to get people to go to war, strategically, look at the outcome of this. Look at what has happened from that, and look at the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who died, and the American soldiers and sailors, Airmen, Marine who died in this war. So when people talk about is torture effective for getting reliable information, it's not just ineffective, it's counterproductive. Right. So it's not that it's not just going to get you inaccurate information. It's going to get you information to make uninformed decisions. And because as I look back at my career, and I started as a police constable in 1976 in Old Lyme, Connecticut, walking a beat, so almost 45 years in this business. What I've recognized is that as an investigator, as someone asking questions, whether you're a detective, a special agent in the private sector, what your real goal is to be able to get information so informed decisions can be made, right? And that can be an informed decision to yourself about what direction you want to take your case in, an informed decision by your boss or supervisor, in my case with NCIS, a general in the Marines or an admiral in the Navy, or some staff judge advocate, or assistant U.S. attorney or local district attorney. But so that some informed decision could be made based on the known information. And that gets back into this effectiveness argument or debate. I can't even really call it that because I don't think there is a debate for people who know what really happens. Is the fact that when you torture, back to your question, not only is it inaccurate, unreliable, but you have now, for lack of a better term, ruined that person. Post-traumatic stress, the long-term effect of that has significant consequences, not just on the person tortured, and that's horrible and bad enough, but on the system, on the process, on the thoughts that we live in a just world, right? From a country, the United States, that was founded upon basic fundamental human rights. So the fact that you would do that causes long-term significant consequences on a system, on the administration of justice, right? On this process that we hold so dear, the rule of law, that we shed blood for, right? To protect and defend this Constitution that talks about these inalienable rights. So that's the heart of the matter is, go back to the USS Cole suspects, or the 9/11 suspects, they remain at Guantanamo now, still in pretrial hearings. Let me say that again, pretrial hearings. Now, more than 20 years after these attacks, they have not yet been brought to justice for the crimes that we suspect and accuse them of because of torture. The bottom line here is, and there's a lot of debate, and I'm sure there will be with the upcoming election, about Guantanamo and the 9/11 suspects, and Never Forget. I hear that every September 11, Never Forget, and the rest of the year, everyone forgets. They like the moniker, they like the hashtag on social media, but few have delved into the depths of what that actually really means, particularly with, you know, this Guantanamo, for lack of a better term, gulag archipelago, that is the residue of dark prisons and black sites, where of the 30 people remaining at Guantanamo, I think there's only 10 going through any type of trial. So you still have prisoners at Guantanamo who remain in indefinite detention without trial, not because of what they did to us, but because of what we did to them. And so when you try to talk about the rule of law, and you try to look at what's going on globally, and the U.S. as an example of the shining city on the hill of what other countries should emulate and seek to be like, it's not that. Right? It's not that. And the other problem, again, from a system of justice with the Guantanamo process, is with torture or prisoner abuse. There is a family of interrogational abuses at play. Some of them may not meet the actual legal definition of torture, but they meet the definition of prisoner abuse and human rights violations and other things. So in the case of Majid Khan, who was a courier for Al-Qaeda, who pleaded guilty, and he went before a panel of military members in this commission process with his guilty plea, they basically nullified his sentence because of the torture inflicted upon him. It's in the public record. I mean, the CIA ground up food and shoved it up his butt. Okay. And so when the military members on that jury or panel heard or her testimony about his treatment, they basically gave him time served. They basically said that, and the one of the members, the foreman of the panel, actually hand wrote a letter to the presiding officer, the judge, about how horrendous the treatment was and how un-American it was. And so that's you know, the victim, others looking at this victimization of this person tortured and saying that we're going to nullify the sentence on this person because of the acts committed upon him. That's the hard issue right now that the next administration will face, is what do we do about torture? Because we've had President Bush who sanctioned torture, but he did it never thinking anyone would find out about it. Right, this was supposed to be this super secret program done in the CIA that only certain people read into this program in the CIA were going to know about it, and these people were going to be taken away and no one would hear from them again. Well, that's unrealistic, right? That just couldn't happen, didn't happen, can never happen, right? And so when you take a look at how that has played out, And the victimization of hundreds, thousands in these families of interrogational abuses, we're stuck in this quagmire. And while President Bush sanctioned torture, President Obama gave it sanctuary with his policies of impunity, where he said, we're going to look forward, not backwards at what we did, but let's forget about all those things. And I think it was naive. He said that during his campaign. He didn't realize the extent of the torture program. He doesn't realize how it permeated agencies within the government. Didn't realize, and I couldn't talk about this until last summer when it became public record, that the FBI actually was part of the torture program, sent agents to black sites, fed questions to people being tortured. You know, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, who should have been the people standing up against this, were actually part of this national program where the government, it was government policy to implement torture. And so that's the critical crux of what's happening. Now, so you have Bush sanctions it. Obama gives it sanctuary. Trump celebrated torture, right? Ran on a campaign. We're going to do stuff worse. Waterboarding works. We're going to get more bad dudes. And really, thus far, the Biden administration has ignored the issue. So there's a big debate where defense counsel, and I testified last summer down at Guantanamo in one of the cases. And so the government tried to reach plea agreements with defense counsel. And when that got to the Secretary of Defense, he quashed it. He put a stop to it, which, having worked as an investigator for NCIS and knowing what the military commission rules are, that is going to be argued as unlawful command influence, where you had someone outside the judicial process exerting unlawful influence on that process. And so that's the issue with plea agreements. And there's a lot of debate whether these people should go instead to federal district court, as in my view, they should have to start with, right? The FBI had a great history working terrorism cases. The Southern District of New York, U.S. Attorney's Office, was the primary district for prosecuting any Osama bin Laden cases. Had a great track record. The skill of the investigators in the, it was called the I-49 squad, the Osama bin Laden squad in the Joint Terrorism Task Force, the NYPD, FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force there, were the folks most experienced in the world at investigating al-Qaeda. And President Bush basically turned his back on that system and said, instead, I'm going to have the Secretary of Defense do these investigations, and said I was charged with, I got that military order to establish a task force and conduct these investigations for these cross-border military commissions. And while I thought it was an unwise decision, it was a lawful one. The president did have the authority under Article 2 of the Constitution to establish some sort of military commissions or tribunals. The Supreme Court has rejected the manner in which it was implemented over the years, but he did have that authority. But you know, the lessons are yet to be learned, because even now, if you try to take those cases to federal court, the discovery rules and cross-examination would likely expose what those in government fears most: accountability for torture policies. And so that's a long answer to your question about torture, but that's really the crux of the issue. Once you go down that road, it's hard to recover. And 20 years later, we still have not recovered from those decisions by President Bush to use torture as an instrument of war.
And who knows how many more years it might take us to recover, if we ever do it all. And that answer certainly provides a ton of additional layers and context to it. And there was one little piece through all of that, even kind of parsing through the context, we think just about the conversations itself, that we're looking to make informed decisions. So an investigator is somebody who asks questions with the goal of gathering information, truthful information, that allows them to make informed decisions. And those informed decisions can be wide ranging. So if we were to use that as an analogy really quick, a CEO could be an investigator, a salesperson could be an investigator, a negotiator could be an investigator, somebody conducting a candidate interview is an investigator, because in all of these scenarios and more, we are looking to obtain truthful information that helps us make more informed decisions in order to achieve goals. And I do want to come back to some of the interrogation stories and examples in just a moment, but to take half a step away from that is sort of an interlude. If we know that putting unnecessary stress and discomfort on people is counterproductive to gathering informed, truthful information to help us make these informed decisions, through your experience, through your lens, your opinion, why do you believe that people in investigations and business, because I see it all the time, well, we're going to do a job interview, we're going to make this person feel really uncomfortable. On what planet is that a good idea? But people, they believe it to be true in their bones. They want to argue with me. Well, I need to see what they operate under stress. Are they going to be under that stress every day in your job? Then why are you doing it to them now? But my rant aside, with your experience and opinion, why do you believe that people still believe it's productive to put people under unnecessary stress as a means to gather truthful information when the empirical data is so strong that says it's a bad idea?
Yeah, let me step back and I'll answer that in two different ways. That first of all, to start with, unfortunately, everyone is not conducting their interviews or interrogations to elicit accurate, reliable information. There is a number of confession-driven practices that are used, and I can talk about research later during this talk, but what the research has found, and I've also had the honor of being the immediate past chair of the High Value Detainee Interrogation Group Research Committee, and so I'm well aware and well versed in the research that has occurred since the establishment of the HIG and a robust research program within the government. But the problem is that these confession-driven tactics are effective at eliciting confessions from the guilty people. Unfortunately, they're also effective at getting confessions from the innocent people. So if your goal is a confession, those type of high pressure situations, and I do expert reviews now, I do that as a living. And what happens is when I look at these, more often than not, it becomes a false concession, right? And so the person is worn down to such a state that their repeated denials are rejected and refuted, and they're not listened to. And rather than listening, the questioner is doing all the talking and implanting memories and shaping the conversation that the person oftentimes just concesses and says, well, you know, that may have been what happened. And then it stops, right? I've got my confession from him or her. I'm going to close this out. I'm not going to allow them now to recant that because that's counterproductive to my objective, is the confession. And then it gets to a prosecutor. And what do they want? A confession. And so they get that. And the person, and I've worked with a number of exonerees and given talks with them and have a lot of private conversations with them about what it was like being victimized by the police and being put in prison for a crime you didn't commit, and talk to them about how was it you falsely confessed to a crime you didn't commit, because I was taught, and I believed, and I taught others that an innocent person wouldn't confess to a crime they didn't commit. Because I was taught that, and I believed that, and I was so wrong. We were so wrong in that belief. But intuitively, that's what you would think. Right. And I have some of my neighbors where I live talk about, well, you know, if you tortured me, I tell you whatever you wanted to know. I said, I know that's exactly the point. Right. It's not what I want to know. It's what you know. And so that's one of the pieces of research. But you talk about in the business community, I do some training in this, and I don't do it. Market it and don't do it widespread, but I do it for selected clients when asked. But I do a course called The Tradecraft of Effective Interviewing. So it's not just about interrogation. It's about what the research tells us. And I mentioned the HIG. And one of the lessons learned post 9/11, based on the bad information we're getting, still under President Bush, recognizing the amount of flawed decisions that were made based on bad information, he directed the Office of Director of National Intelligence, the ODNI, to conduct a study of why this was happening. Why was it that in this day and age, 2001, 2003, we were conducting interrogations and getting all this bad information? How is that possible when we've spent millions of dollars on training soldiers in the Army Field Manual on interrogation? And why is it we were getting all this bad information? And a study was conducted, and they visited, this study group visited me at FLETC and went to the FBI Academy, and Boston Police Department went around. And what they found was that it had been 50 years since the U.S. government had invested any research into why someone would give me, a guy like me or like you, accurate, reliable information when we talk to them. So our methodologies were based on customary learning. And I wrote a piece in Police Chief Magazine a few years back called Untruths and Consequences, where I talked about this, where someone would come in and tell a war story, and I'll talk about how I did this case and how this worked for me, and then I'm going to expect you to replicate that, even though your circumstances are different and everything's different, but this worked for me, kid, so this ought to work for you because I got this plaque on the wall that says that I was good at this, right? And that's a fallacy. So this study produced a report in 2006 called educing information. And that's what found that it had been this 50 years. And so when President Obama took office and decided to establish this multi-agency task force called the HIG, with a director from the FBI, one deputy director from the CIA, and another deputy director from the Department of Defense, because President Obama said when he issued his executive order, 13491, in his first few days in office, who said, we will not torture anymore, but we do need to know the most effective means at obtaining information to protect our national security. Right, this is critical for our country, right? It's critical to public safety that we do this right. And so today, I'm pleased to say today that we went from almost none to over 150 government-funded research projects into effective interviewing. And that has resulted in more than 225 peer-reviewed publications about this. And so now we know what is effective. And that has resulted in a sea change amongst many federal agencies. My former agency, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, where I was the assistant director for training, has totally revamped their training program for federal agents. Their behavioral science division now only uses research-based methodologies in their training. And when I was the assistant director there, we did not. We were still using confession-driven methodologies to try to train our federal agents to get confessions. They do no more. All right. When I was the director of the NCS Training Academy, we were not using science to determine how we should do our training. We were using this customary learning where I was one of the people who said, hey, based on all these interrogations that we did post 9/11, one thing I know that developing themes does not work, right? And so forget about any of that stuff. We're going to develop a new methodology. We're going to stop training that stuff because I knew these rapport-based methods worked. We were going to try to do that based on our experience that rapport works. Well, now we have research that has actually validated those experiences. And so that's the nice part about the research, because for me, as a, I'm now called a pracademic because I'm a practitioner and I have a foot in academia. I did 3 years as a visiting scholar at John Jay College for Criminal Justice, looking at interrogation specifically. And of course, all my time on the with the Higg Research Committee and other groups. What I've learned from the research is it has validated why some of the things that I thought were effective, right? So now I understand why when I did this, this was an outcome. It's also taught me that some of the things I did were not as effective as I thought they were, and that there's some things that I did I should never, ever do again because they're either ineffective or counterproductive. And so when people now start to embrace this research and then incorporate it into their training program, you're going to see a major shift in the effectiveness of effective interviewing, right? And that's the key. And I'm very proud of my old organization, NCIS, because not this summer, last summer, the director came out with an edict to the field. We called it a gen administration, a general administration of the field, and said, I don't care how you've previously been trained. I don't care what your previous practice has been. From this day forward, we will only use research to guide our interview and interrogation practices. And they sent researchers to the NCS Academy. They retrained the instructors. They taught supervisors in the field about what is effective so that they're not counterproductive and telling someone, don't do that. I didn't do it that way. And so we're seeing this great kind of new wave of effective interviewing. And we can talk about the Mendes principles later if you'd like. But this is monumental. In my career, we saw an amazing sea change, my NCIS background. So talk about sea change, when DNA came out, right? So this DNA has revolutionized crime scenes, right? We collect evidence differently. We're now looking for biological materials, and hair follicles that can tell us things that never could before, and cigarette butts and other things. And so that has really changed the manner in which we do crime scenes. NCIS now has its first canine unit. The dog is to sniff out electronic media, right? That's how far we've come. NCIS never had a drug dog or a bomb dog. They now have a dog that can sniff out hidden electronic devices and things like that. And so law enforcement needs to change and evolve with these advancements in science. That is happening right now at the federal level and in certain pockets of excellence at the state and local level. It is not yet culturally evolved. In October, I'll be speaking at the International Associations of Chiefs of Police annual conference in Boston. I'm the past chair of the IMPACT section, which is the International Managers of Police Academy and College Training. And I'm a member of the PRAS section, Police Research Advancement section. And there's going to be a research symposium at the ICP for those interested in evidence-based policing. And I'm going to give a talk about these advancements in interrogation research and practice with the hope that it will start to filter down to the state and local level. Now, LAPD has morphed their practices. There's some great work going on in California. There's a DA out there named Vern Pearson who's embraced the research, who's making sure that that his officers are trained in this. I was out giving training in Wichita, Kansas PD. They have some great champions for science-based interrogation. There's these pockets of excellence in Dallas PD. But there's these isolated, right? It has not yet been a cultural shift from confession-driven tactics that are counterproductive. People are still using false evidence ploys. We have evidence, and we know they produce bad information. We know people falsely confess to crimes they didn't commit. But if your goal is a confession, you're getting it. And so that's why I'm out there giving talks. I do work with the Innocence Project. I have now spoken before 10 state legislatures, given testimony or visited their capitals, met with senators and representatives, trying to convince them that we need legislative change to help push down the fact that there's now research that can inform the practice.
That's where I would love to spend a couple of minutes, if we can, is talking about the best practices, talking about the changes. Because I feel like when you mentioned that, like, cultural shift, a lot of times, whether it's law enforcement, private sector organizations, the example you gave earlier, I did it this way and it worked for me. Therefore, you should do it this exact way, even though the context is largely too entirely different. You mentioned the Mendez principles. You mentioned the Hague. You mentioned evidence-based practices. Really, all of that boils down to techniques that work to encourage people to share accurate and reliable information. So for the people that are listening and are like, oh, give me that. What do I need to do to encourage people to share accurate and reliable information in any of my investigative or business conversations? What are the best techniques that we should be using now to encourage people to tell us the truth?
Yeah, there are a number. So there's not one context. When I teach or what I advocate for, there's a few, I'll call them bands of research that I use when I teach the tradecraft of effective interviewing.
Yes.
And so, you know, for witness interviews, particularly the cognitive interview.
Love it.
Fisher and Geiselman developed this years ago for interviews of children, because the psychological underpinnings are about better memories, more clear and accurate memories. And so I've done some work on crisis or hostage negotiations, working for the United Nations, looking to get a hostage who was in custody by an Al-Qaeda affiliated group in Yemen, right? And so I was a consultant to the United Nations on that, developing strategies. And as part of that, I went around and I would interview, I do a debriefing of other hostages that have been released by Al-Qaeda affiliated groups in Yemen, because I want to learn the methodology. What would be the best strategies to get our client released? Let's look at how others in other contexts or from other countries were released. And in those debriefings, I've now debriefed three different hostages who were held in Yemen by these Al-Qaeda affiliate groups. And I used a combination of what the research has shown me. I've used the cognitive interview.
Yes.
Right? Because I know that that is effective. There's some interview about open windows, open doors, open spaces, right? About embodied cognition. And so understanding that, I would ensure that the environment that I use was unlike your traditional interrogation room, which is the opposite of what the research on embodied cognition shows. The research about the interrogation space should be, and I hate the term softer because they call it that, but it should be a softer room, right? It should not be this confined room where the person's put in a corner and your back's to the door so they can't escape. You could tackle them if they try to go out. And that just adds the pressure and amps up the pressure, which degrades memory and hurts the process. So there are a few. The strategic use of evidence.
Yes.
Right. You know, this is Dr. Murray Hartwig, at John Jay, was one of those who pioneered that research. It was sometimes called the funnel approach, mm-hmm. where you start out. And there's a lot of misconceptions about that because of the early research that talks about the presentation of evidence. People sometimes, the uninformed or misinformed, talk about it's about late presentation of evidence. Well, sometimes, but it's about strategic presentation of evidence. It's about the proper planning, and it's about knowing when to do that. And what the research shows is that the SUE technique, the strategic use of evidence, is very effective at eliciting admissions or lies from the guilty, because as an investigator, I don't mind a lie. If I can prove you're lying, I'm making my case, mm-hmm. right? And so that helps me if you lie to me. Actually, I like when you lie to me, because the best method of detecting deception is a known or checkable fact. So if I'm using the strategic use of evidence, So the psychological underpinnings of that are about counterinterrogation strategies, right? And so what the research does is looks at, almost like game theory, right? What would be your counterinterrogation strategy? And I'm going to outplay you. Mm-hmm. I'm going to counter that. So that's the psychological underpinnings of that. And what that allows you to do, which is the great part, is exonerate the innocent, right? And so that's key. There's Orbit, all right? This is about rapport-based interviewing at University of Liverpool up there, and Lawrence Allison, Emily Allison, and that crew up there have done that. He wrote the book Orbit. I wrote the foreword to the book Orbit for Lawrence, and I teach about Orbit. And that's about rapport, but it really gets into kind of the dynamics of the inner person. So because your goal is to get information. So if a person has more dominant tendencies, the counter to get them talking more is to have a more submissive approach, because that will draw more data out. Right. And the opposite may be true. And there's a wheel, and I don't want to get into kind of all of that training, but that is being done right now and taking root in a lot of training. And I am delighted to see that.
I'm delighted to hear it. And by the way, let me double down on recommending the cognitive interview, memory enhancing techniques, Geiselman and Fisher, and also Orbit. I'll share links to those books, including your books as well, in the show notes. I can't recommend those two books enough. But just what you said there, when somebody is being dominant, don't meet them head on. Play a more, to use the word, a submissive role to encourage them to open up and talk more, and use their dominance to draw them into the conversation. I can't tell you how many times, either in investigative roles or now more in executive resource roles, where I feel hear people saying, well, this person is going to be a bully. They're going to be dominant. They're going to be arrogant. So I'm going to beat them to it. I'm going to meet them there. I'm going to show them I won't be pushed around. Have fun getting nothing.
Yep.
They're the ones with the information. We need to obtain it. So that's, I know I cut you off there. I apologize, but that's such an important little piece to call out that, again, is counterintuitive. You don't get information in so many of these circumstances, truthful, actionable, to help us make informed decisions. You don't get that by bullying people, by stressing people out, by painting them in corners. One of my favorite interrogations was when I got called by a police department who was having trouble with the serial burglary scenario, and they thought they had the right person, but they couldn't get her over the line. They couldn't get her to say yes. I show up into your stereotypical interrogation room with the law and order mirror in the background, the whole thing. And they had the table set up. So she would be in the corner. I'd be across the table in front of her. She'd be facing the mirror. I'd be blocking the door. I walked in. I'm like, hey, I need 5 minutes. I rearranged the whole room. I got rid of the table. I put it underneath the mirror. I put myself in the corner. I put her sitting closest to the door. Do all these things. And by the way, one guy is screaming at me for how I'm wrong. I don't know what I'm doing. All this stuff. By the end of the ensuing interview, we find out it's not her. It's her daughter. They were on the right block. They had the wrong person. So all of these things are so important. With the few minutes that we've got left, we've been kind of approaching the best practices piece, what you've learned from the research and the Hague and all these things. But let's flip it once back, maybe try to come full circle. In the beginning, we looked at the awful things that torture does to people. Now, can we look a little bit about what the rapport-based techniques do for people? We help them save face, protect their self-image, have some agency, some ownership in the conversation, how that impacts people and helps us achieve our goals?
Yeah, for sure. That's what's really encouraging right now. And, you know, as you know, you're going to have a link up. I'm one of the co-editors of the new volume, the new book out, Interviewing Interrogation, A Review of History and Practices, World War II. And we go into all this. We go into this evolution and kind of where we're at today and the encouraging news. And I can't go into that detail without mentioning, as we mentioned before, the Mendes principles. Yeah. On effectivity, because this is now global. So there is a global movement going on. In 2016, Juan Mendez, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, was ending his tenure, and he had to give a thematic to the United Nations about the state of global policing when it comes to interviewing interrogation. And he had asked me, there were about 100 or 200 advisors he had to this thematic that he had to deliver. And I was one of those. I was very honored to be asked by Juan to help him as he was writing this thematic. And having known all about the research, what my contribution was is that whatever we utilize needs to be based in science, right? That if there's some type of scientific grounding, the likelihood of success is better than if it's not, better than chance, better than luck, better than I did it this way with this person, you're going to get the same results. You do it differently with some other person, right? And so that resulted in 2017, I spoke at the General Assembly, the United Nations in New York City, and a movement was started on the the official term is the principles of effective interviewing. But a three-entity coordinating group was established with the Anti-Torture Initiative at George Washington University, at Marquette University, George Washington Law School there, the Norwegian Center for Human Rights out in Oslo, Norway, and the Association for Prevention of Torture out of Geneva. Well, they put together a 12-person group of experts to try to come up with a global standard, a universal standard. And I was honored to be among those 12 global experts, 12 or 15, I forget the number right now. I think it was 15. And we worked for 4 years. We had an advisory council of over 100 people from 50 countries. The past president of the International Association of Chiefs of Police was on our advisory council. But people from around the world, and we distilled down to 6 pillars, and you'll be able to have the link to the Mendes principles on the podcast. And on the volume I mentioned, one of the things we did was made sure it was available for free, right? Because that's one of the obstacles we found was, why don't police embrace research? One, we don't know the research. We don't have access to it. And it costs money. There's these paywalls. So the volume we wrote, we had a publisher who we made a deal with. We'll take no royalties. As a public service, we want to get this into the hands. So electronically, the digital copy is free. And your listeners and people who watch the show can have that. And that's the same with the Mendes principle. So we worked down for 4 years into the principles of effective interviewing. And there's six pillars, and it talks about training and how interviewing is a profession.
Yes.
It's not intuitive. Actually, sometimes it's counterintuitive, especially if you watch television shows or movies. Very counterintuitive to what scriptwriters think it ought to be. But basically, this distills down to three things. And it's hard, I think, for people to argue against these things, that interrogation or interviewing, and in the Mendes principles, we intentionally call it effective interviewing. We don't just call it interrogation, because in some parts of the world, you can't say interrogation. They get all sorts of hives and high blood pressure over the term rather than the practice. Mm-hmm. And some call it investigative interviewing. But what about intelligence interviewing? It applies there. And so we decided effective interviewing would be the term we use. But what we came up with was effective interviewing needs to be based on law, on science, and on ethics. And so the IACP impact section that I'm the past chair of has endorsed the Mendes principles. The American Bar Association has endorsed the Mendes principles. There are countries around the world, the United Nations police have totally revamped their training program, and other entities of the UN, and now globally, are teaching the Mendes principles. And so this is part of the curriculum. When I teach, is all Mendes compliant. And so when I talked, I just spoke at the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judge Conference in Phoenix, Arizona. And what I tried to convince judges and administrative court personnel is that your legal standard of voluntariness doesn't take into effect the unreliability of some of those voluntary statements. And so the new standard ought to be about what is reliable. And if you use the Mendes principles as that standard, you're going to ensure that what you're looking at in court, or if your police department does it, your department, or if your CEO can look at these, because the science is universal. It's about effective interviewing. It's about questioning. So it applies in all of those contexts, is that your methods are based on law, science, and ethics. And I've yet to have anybody argue with me that our practice ought to be unethical. Our practice ought to be unscientific, right? And or it should be unlawful, our practice. And so that's kind of that's what I find really encouraging right now, are these pockets of excellence in policing that I highlight. And I highlighted intentionally Wichita Police Department, LAPD, Vern Pearson, El Dorado County, California, the district attorney out there, the FLETC, NCIS, Air Force OSI. Right now, everyone who goes through the FLETC criminal investigator training program, so all of those federal agents who then go on to Secret Service or U.S. Marshals or ICE or the respective inspectors general, they're all getting now, just for the last 2 years, evidence-based training, research methodologies that are implanted. And in the volume that I know you'll have for your readers,
of course,
we have a chapter in here in that evolution of FLETC. We have chapters in here about how you can go about it, about memory, what the latest is. And what we did is we asked the scientist to write it for practitioners.
Very nice.
Because I need an interpreter when I read some of these research projects.
Me too.
And so what we said is, actually the book is the result of a subcommittee when I was on the IACP Impact chair, is I said, why isn't this research getting out there? And the subcommittee said some of what I mentioned. Research costs money. People are operating in two different silos. Academics don't trust practitioners. Practitioners don't trust anybody who hasn't kicked the door and carried a gun, right? Sure. We have a different credibility level than they do. We don't care about their degrees, and academics don't care about our practice sometimes, not all the time. And so we went around the world and we selected more than 20 countries, 25, I forget how many different countries, but we have chapters written for practitioners that can help them evolve their practice. And I know we're getting to the end of our talk, but if I could just make one other point here.
Of course.
As a career law enforcement professional that still is involved in this field, it's troubling to see the problems we're having with recruitment and retention of officers right now.
Certainly.
I was really happy to see that just about 2 months ago, for the first time in years, the public has a more positive view of policing. And that had not been the case in the preceding years. And so whatever is being done out there now, whether it's additional scrutiny, whether it's cultural change, whether it's like we say in IACP, we need to reimagine policing. We need to police the way the public expects us to police, not expect the public to adapt to the way we want to police. But if we start embracing this research, it will help restore trust, community trust, right? Because we're not just treating suspects with false evidence, ploys, and lying. We're doing that to witnesses and victims. And even the suspect who didn't commit the crime that you've lied to now goes back and says, the cops lied to me about, they claimed I did it. And so you talk about this degradation of trust. Well, I truly believe that if we start policing with virtue, using law, science, and ethics as our foundation, as our guiding principles, then we can move from community-oriented policing to community-embraced policing, and turn us back into the good guys again.
A much-needed evolution, and I don't say that as a slight to law enforcement. Just looking at the dynamic world and conditions that we live in, the context changing on all sides at all times. You know, working to keep pace with that will be so important. We just
need to evolve. That's all we need to do.
Yeah. No matter what anybody wants to say, we can't live, be healthy, function, and raise our families in the world without law enforcement.
Right.
You can't do it. You,
critical.
That one conversation you had in high school about anarchy might have felt fun, but it doesn't work. Yep. Not for most of us anyway. You shared so much today and so much depth, context, reference. I've been taking notes. I'll have links to all of your books, including Unnecessary Means was the book you wrote.
Unjustifiable Means,
I don't think you mentioned, I'll make sure that's in there as well. I have no doubt that there's plenty of people that are saying, whoa, there's a lot there I didn't know, a lot I haven't heard about before. For the people who would like to connect with you and learn more from you and from your work, where should they go?
Yeah, I have a website, markfallon.us.
Okay.
And you can click on the icon and send me an email or a note. I'm very active speaking publicly. As I mentioned, I'll be at the International Associated Chiefs Police Conference in October. I go every year. I'm a past chair of the Impact Section. And I'm really delighted, as I said, there's for the first time, we're having a research symposium in an ICP conference.
That's awesome.
And so the Research Advisory Council and the Police Research Advancement Section have combined, and we're going to have sessions on evidence-based policing, where we need to have this cultural shift where we now start to embrace science rather than reject it.
For sure. And you mentioned the unfortunate divide, chasm between academics and practitioners historically. We are all out of good reasons not to have bridges built between the two, because there are absolutely lessons to be learned from both. And the more we can apply the right science to the right areas, especially when it comes to gaining truthful and accurate information to make more informed decisions that keep all of us safe, it's, as you said earlier, it's really tough to argue against that.
Yep, no doubt.
Thank you so much for your time. It has been my pleasure. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to hopefully many more conversations with you in the future.
My pleasure as well. Thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Take care. Mark, thank you very much for an extremely insightful conversation. I appreciate all that you shared historically from your experience, what the research says, positive examples, negative examples, the opportunity to apply it inside and outside of the world of investigation. Thank you so very much for the time that you put in and all that you shared with us today. I truly appreciate it. I took a bunch of notes. Hope everybody else did as well. Even just how you started the conversation, torture can be effective. But for what? What is it really effective doing? And is it really effective doing the things that we need to do, getting us the right information, true and accurate information to make the best decisions? And the answer is very clear. It's not. I also like the distinction you made between a false concession and a false confession. But that was very important. And I love how you articulated it. And I also love the concept of going into a conversation that it's not about what I want to know. It's about what you know. I don't want you to tell me what I want to know. I want you to tell me what you actually know. And those are two very, very, very important distinctions. And I truly appreciate you sharing it with us. Thank you, Mark. And thank you to everybody that took the time to listen to this conversation. Again, I hope you got just much, if not more, out of it than I did. Before we go, let's thank our sponsors one more time. We have HumanTel. If you haven't already, head over to HumanTel.com. Enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off their best-in-class online training to accurately identify when people's emotions are shifting in real time through their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. It's all backed by science and research, which is all there on their website to read for yourself. Lots of great education there. Enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off the training at HumanTel.com. Please, if you're a professional interviewer, also head over to the CertifiedInterviewer.com. CertifiedInterviewer.com is where you'll find all of your answers to the International Association of Interviewers. What does it take to join? Who qualifies? Organizational level, individual level? What kind of networking opportunities are there? Interviewer resources, education, online, in person, all of that is there for you. That is also where you can learn more about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. What does it take to qualify? How do you pass the exam? What's included in the exam? What does the designation do for you in your career after? And how do you maintain the designation? What are the professional, moral, legal, ethical standards that you need to maintain? All of that is there for you at CertifiedInterviewer.com. And while you're online, please check out INQUASIVE.com. That's where you can see the programs that we customize for our clients anytime they ask us to teach their senior leaders, business development teams, or HR teams how to encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences with strategic and ethical observation and persuasion techniques, all designed to help build stronger relationships and achieve better outcomes. It's all there for you at INQUASIVE.com. Check it out. Thank you so much. Before you head out, please like the show, share the show, subscribe to the show, tell your friends about it. Give us your feedback. What would you like to see more of, hear less of? Please let us know. We appreciate you being here week after week. Thank you so much. Stay safe. Take care of each other, and we'll see you next time.